Hello, my fellow podcastians. It's Woz again with Mastering Done Podcast. Look, I decided to jump straight back in. So I'm actually recording this little bit the day after I did the other one. Might not release it straight away, but you know, I thought while onto a good thing, we should keep it going. It's nice and bright and early here. The sun's out. The sky is somewhat blue, and I felt like having a chat with you. So, and that was a nice poem too, wasn't it? So I actually had some subjects that were put to me by, of course, my good mate, Hero, and also my brother, and I felt like I'd talk about them today because I also watched a documentary the other day which really made me have flashbacks and reminisce about a show that I really hold dear from my childhood, but I kind of, still a bit of a soft spot for today. More the idea of it, I think, than the show itself, because I think I'd probably watch one episode and be done. But my brother's suggestion was to talk about anime, but more specifically the kind of cartoons and things that we watched when we were younger that we really... There's, I think, an age where... Well, particularly boys, but look, I could be wrong. That could be across the board. I know my daughter loves the new Voltron, which is awesome. The fact that she loves it, I haven't watched the new Voltron. But I loved the old Voltron, the Lion Force Voltron, more than the Vehicle Force Voltron. It was an 80s cartoon that I really, really liked. Fond memories of my brother making a Lion Force Voltron out of Lego, and the wonderful thing being the little legs unfolded and it could actually be connected together to create Voltron. Now, I don't know, if I was showed a photo of it today, I'd probably laugh and think, oh, okay. But in my mind's eye, in the memory that I have of it, it was amazing. I loved it. I worshipped him for his skill. Still do. But that was one cartoon that we really, really loved. And I was thinking about it when he said, oh, you should talk about this, and pondering some of the ones we enjoyed. And he also brought up, you know, Astro Boy and Mysterious Cities of Gold, which I'll get to in a moment. But I thought I'd deal with Voltron. I think because we'll work through a couple of my favourites. So there's tons of cartoons from the 80s, the 90s. It just keeps going. It's something that never really goes away. There's always a new fad when it comes to the shows that are on television, whether they've been done in comic book form or not. But they get their fan base, and they've got their toys, and they've got their... Maybe sometimes we've made into a movie as far as like Pokemon goes and things like that. But in this case, I'm thinking more about the shows that I really loved and more specifically a few that I, you know, just really, really liked. So yeah, Voltron to begin with is basically like a massive robot that defends the galaxy, the universe. It's sort of a little unclear in the intro, done by Peter Cullen of Optimus Prime fame, and also, you know, just Transformers on the whole, but a whole bunch of voiceover work that he used to do. But he does the intro voice that kind of talks about what Voltron is and what his job is. But I remember the King Harkon, I think, Harkron, something like that, and his son, who was the prince, and there was a bit of a love interest thing, I think, with the female character that's part of the Voltron team, and they're always fighting off against some massive beast or robot or creature that they've managed to summon in an effort to try and take over and, you know, rule the galaxy. And you're just waiting for that moment where the Lion Force can assemble, because they'll normally fight for a little while and then there comes a moment where they need to assemble and create Voltron and his sword so he can, you know, take out the bad guy. And that was always like the perfect moment, you know, just waiting for that the whole time. They may have done it in a couple where they weren't all together, so they weren't able to fully complete it, and they were always an interesting one. But yeah, on the whole, it was just an awesome show. You've got primary colours for the use of the lions and the character suits, and you could used to buy that as a toy as well. Always wanted the Lion Force Voltron, but it was one of those really expensive toys to sort of get the whole thing. I had like a soft rubber Vehicle Voltron for a while as a kid. I actually really liked it because it all slotted together to create the the Vehicle Force Voltron and then come apart again, you can use all the pieces individually. And that was just small, so you could sort of take that away with you. It wasn't this big cumbersome toy. But that was really a favourite. That was a really great show that we really enjoyed watching when it was out. Astro Boy was another one, but I think first of all deal with He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. I just recently watched a Netflix documentary on the Power of Grayskull. I think that's the name of the documentary, The Power of Grayskull, or The Story of Grayskull. But anyway, you can have a look. I'm sure it'll be there. Just type He-Man, it'll come up if you're interested. If anyone from the 80s has fond memories of He-Man, go check it out. And it talks about the history. It's basically its beginnings, the story of how it just ballooned out into something crazy and kind of maybe did itself in by being a bit too ambitious with some of its ideas. Like a lot of toy lines, like a lot of shows and fads that come along. It has its day, it has its peak, and then all of a sudden it's gone almost overnight, and they try to reignite it at some point, and it never quite sort of gets to the same level that it used to be. But basically, He-Man was started as a toy line, and this was the interesting story of it. It actually started as the toy and then became the show and the movie ultimately as well, the 87 movie with Dolph Lundgren. And it was something that came out of, they were going to make toys for Conan the Barbarian, which came out in 1982, I think. And because of the rating that Conan the Barbarian ended up getting, they really couldn't market it with toys. It just wasn't going to be an appropriate thing, because I think at that time they didn't have all of the different ratings that they do now, and it was simply an R-rated movie. So certainly not accessible by anyone under 10, for sure, let alone even young teenagers. So they had to rethink what they were doing. But they had some of these ideas already on the way. So they needed to use some of those ideas in how they changed it to, I guess, justify the cost, all the tooling, the casts. And so they decided to create this somewhat of a sword and sorcery kind of character, a bit like Conan, but then also with flavours of sci-fi and something that was very, you know, universally appealing to children without being too violent. But it started off with all these, and it's funny just how random the characters' names were come up with. You think He-Man is such a strange name, but we remember it exactly for what it is, and we don't think too much of the strangeness of the title. They just decided to call it He-Man, and they've got Ram-Man, and they've got Mer-Man and Beast-Man, and none of that mattered. We loved it. We thought it was great, and I think giving them simple names makes it easy to remember for kids. And they would use the same tooling, or almost all the same tooling, especially in the early days, to create most of the characters. So even Mer-Man, there was also Stinkor, which just used the front of a character called, the armor of a character called Mechanic, and the actual body of Mer-Man just painted differently. So they and I think they tried to give it some sort of smell, like it really did stink, but I'm not sure what they were able to achieve with that. But I like that lo-fi approach to trying to get something off the ground. They used all the same body mold and then just changed the head and then give them a different weapon. But then also to give the characters some background, they wrote small comic books to introduce the characters into the universe of He-Man, the story of He-Man, where he's from, this fabled planet of Eternia. And, excuse me. And I just love the way that it basically built up out of nothing, a failed toy line that they couldn't use, and they just had to create something that might be along the same vein, but be able to get kids involved in it. And they achieved it beautifully. They achieved it beautifully. They were able to get a balance of kind of cool, but still soft enough to be wide age ranging, But you've got bad guys, good guys, you've got castles, swords, monsters. And then a cartoon came along in the end as well from Filmation. And a memory I used to have, and I'm not sure it was a fond one, but I remember the feeling of being so happy when Filmation would come up and sort of go across the screen, and then you hear a little sort of tinkle sound. And we would know that it was either going to be He-Man or Scooby-Doo and Friends. And we were so shattered if it was Scooby-Doo and Friends, because it just wasn't. I mean, we'd watch it, but it just wasn't on the same level at all. And was so pumped if it was He-Man. And that was kind of, I think they'd swap it occasionally. They'd swap it in and out of the time slot. So it was always a mystery. You know, now you know what's coming on every day of the week and you can choose what to watch. But back then it was a bit more linear. You just had to go with it. So, but that was a fond memory. And we used to love watching the cartoon. I forget if it was a morning cartoon or an afternoon one. I feel like perhaps it was an early morning one at some stage as well. It probably changed over the years. But yeah, we got several toys from the line. We didn't go crazy with them, but we had a few bits and pieces. And I had Land Shark, which was my only vehicle. But we also had, we had Mechanic, Battle Armor He-Man, which I lost when we moved house. Also Power Punch or Power Pack He-Man, where he had a cap, like a gun cap in his backpack, and you could switch that around and pull the character back around and do it like a punch, and the cap would go off like a real powerful punch. That was kind of cool. I never had the standard He-Man, so I must have come into it a bit later than most or something. But we had Webster. He had like a grappling hook with a string like into a backpack. We had Leech, who was actually from Hordak and the Horde, which was a Shearer, was the Shearer bad guys. And we also had Hordak. I had Hordak. We had Roboto, which was this see-through kind of cyborg robot thing. And you could see the gears working when you turn the character. I got Cyclone, which I think might have been a latecomer, because his tooling was quite different. And I think that was when their budget could blossomed out through the roof and they could make whatever they wanted. And he would spin around using like a little wheel on his waist, and his top half would spin around with his arms out like a cyclone. What else was there? There was a Skeletor that had this dragon on his back that had was sprayed water. And I remember the comic for that one particularly. I think my brother got that, my younger brother. But we didn't have a... I don't think we had a standard Skeletor, but we had him. And that could be it. That could be it. I could be wrong. There could be more there. But there was a bunch, but I know that Eero has talked about it fondly as well, and he had a lot of stuff that he, I think, left in England when he made the big move over here. And man, that would have hurt. I mean, we never had Castle Grayskull or Snake Mountain or anything, but yeah, I think to have all of that and then lose it would have been very painful. So it would have been very, very cool. But even just learning about how they did the castle is amazing too. I mean, somebody originally sits down, sculpts it out of clay, and then they basically mold it from there. And they talked about the paint job not being that exciting or hard to achieve, and they literally hand sprayed the second colour on just to achieve a slight different look. So sort of shadows in the eye sockets on Castle Grayskull, or in the mouth, or whatever was the case. And I just think that stuff's great. I think that that's a really cool way to modify and adapt each of them, customize them. Each and every one is just a little bit different. And that was probably just a cost saving exercise, but it also makes them purely unique then. So He-Man is definitely a huge one. This documentary is fascinating because it talks about all the artists involved and the animators and directors and the people that have made these decisions, like just executives sitting there who create some of the characters and have the ideas just because they're going, all right, let's try this. And it's so random that you don't know whether that should be a good thing or a bad thing. But I love that it must have had something already. There was a magic there waiting to be mined, and I think that they achieved it with He-Man. And it got to such a level where they had tons and tons of characters, more vehicles, the syndicated show, of course, the movie that they tried, and then I think it really fell out of the market and just started to become something where there was just a bit of oversupply. And so, like most things, I guess once that surge had been had its rise and fall, started to subdue a little and quieten down, and people start to lose interest or gain interest in other things, I think you could safely say there was probably only a couple of years between where He-Man kind of went out of the public consciousness and it started to be about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Is that started to really gain traction around 1990 and then onwards from there. And that would have been the next huge thing. But yeah, poor old He-Man then was left in the dirt a little bit, which was sad. But I recall, because of course, in that era following, you could get the like box sets of DVDs and so on, but you could normally only get like this huge one. It was probably about $250. So nothing that I would consider getting. So I hadn't actually seen the show for a long, long time, and it was before YouTube really gained traction. It was probably very early 2000s. And a friend of mine had a DVD, just like a mixed DVD of He-Man episodes. And so I wouldn't have seen any of the show since, or even heard the song, since the end of probably the TV show, whenever I, you know, stopped watching that or they took it off TV, which I couldn't tell you when it was. It just feels like it faded out. But I recall putting it on in it was quite late at night, and I think I was up to give my son a bottle of milk, because he was at that age where he still, you know, had a very, very early morning bottle of milk. And I recall just putting it on, because the idea was to keep myself awake, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right, I've got that DVD. And I actually got, I don't mind admitting, I actually got emotional when I heard the song very quietly and just relived that introduction part. I actually felt quite emotional about it. And it still makes me a little bit, I don't know, it makes me reminisce in that way, where you get that glint in the eye and you kind of, you know, it's just like, huh. And you just remember it with joy. You know, it might sound a little cheesy, but I don't know, something about He-Man does that for me. It's just got a certain magic that not all the other shows kind of had, but it certainly did. So I remember He-Man with a lot of fondness. Another one that we were all very, very keen on when we were young was Astro Boy. A Japanese, I guess, anime cartoon that was on for a long time. And I think originally, from what I can tell anyway, I haven't really ever looked into the history of it, really. I know that there was a black and white version. I think perhaps it was late 60s and 70s. And then they did an early 80s colour version, and that was the version that we saw on television for so long. And I'm not sure, I don't think it changed much from that original vision. I think it's just they added colour, and they maybe had different voice talent. I'm not sure if they even did the English translation on the first series or not, so I probably should have a look at it just for historical sake and a bit of a learning curve. But yeah, the 80s Astro Boy was a real favourite of ours as well. I guess for the same reasons as He-Man. You know, you hear the song, you see the character, you know who's in it, you wonder what he's going to be up to today. and I suppose just the whole idea of a boy being a super powerful robot that has the ability to fly and to shoot machine guns out of his butt, which was a bit of a strange idea, really, but I don't know, I never thought it was cheesy, it seemed to work. And the theme song, which was a really, really cheesy, so a bit like the He-Man one's got this sort of 70s disco thing about it, but it just is great. The Astro Boy song is a very, very cheesy song, but it seems to grab onto the same emotions and excite you as the young child watching it back then. And, you know, you grab your Ugg boots, so you've got the same sort of shoes on as Astro Boy. Strip to your underpants and off you go. But Astro Boy was one of those things where there was a few voice talents, and they would do all the voices. So there was a character called Atlas, which turned out to be somewhat of Astro Boy's twin. And he was, even though he looked completely different, essentially they were built to the same concept and design, like elements of their design were the same. So they started to refer to each other as brothers. And but he was like the arch nemesis who only had moments of good in him. But they were always interesting storylines. But the one that always stood out, and I think still to this day, is the one that I could probably watch it repeated times without getting tired of. It was a two-part series about the most powerful robot in the world. It could have been called The Strongest Robot or something like that, but it was about that. It was about the most powerful robot in the world and kind of this little guy that had evil machinations to send his robot around the world to defeat all of these famous strong robots. And its name was Bruton, and it was this huge blue robot with these big horns on it, and it could electrocute things between the horns if it managed to capture them or have them hold on to both horns, and it could basically electrocute them till they blow up. And it was a really cool robot because it was just, I think it could fly like a tornado as well. And it was just a thing of brute force. It was huge. So it fought like a lumberjack one. It fought, this is the thing, I'm not even going to be able to think of them all now. There was one that looked like a Greco-Roman sort of gladiator. There was even one who was a just gentle school teacher in the southern continent, they call it. But of course, when you see this classroom with Uluru / Ayers Rock in the background, you know that it means Australia, and you're sort of out in the middle of which is actually the dead center of the country in the desert, but that doesn't matter. It's all the iconography of it all. And fights him, and he's supposed to be one of the most powerful. They talk about horsepower in it, and it sort of goes up in levels of horsepower and what these different robot skills are and everything. And then of course Astro Boy was on the list, and I think Bruton defeats him once, and then because Astro survives, they then face each other again later on down the track. And so there's this kind of not camaraderie, but a sort of a respect between them or something, like an understanding. And I don't know, there's something about those episodes that just really grabbed our imagination, and we really loved those ones. There was a couple of others where they had a Frankenstein kind of robot that was created, but there was also one from, it crashed into Earth and it was in a globe, but it was like a puzzle. So you pulled it apart and it became all these pieces, and then Astro reassembled it according to how those pieces computed in his mind, and it created another robot, which then started to try and terraform Earth, or at least one part of it, even to the extent of changing the air supply there. And yeah, so that was a really cool episode as well. I mean, there were so many that you'd lose count, but there were some great ones. And then there was one more before I move on. I'll just keep going otherwise. There was also another one where there's a robot without a head. It kind of has the features of a face on its torso, but it's trying and trying and trying to find itself a head, a new head. And it keeps, basically, it's like a serial killer with sort of a one-track mind. It needs to find its head and disregard all others, and keeps tearing the heads off all these other robots on a kind of a spree around the city. And yeah, it's basically like a serial killer, but like robots Sorry, just had to stop hard for someone who didn't realize that cars have indicators. Yeah, so that was actually, that was a really good episode as well. So anyway, there's lots of them, and I could reel them off until, you know, until nighttime, basically. One more, because I just thought of it. There was another one where there's a school trip, because Astro sort of tries to do some of the things that make him feel a bit more like a boy. And so he does have a school class, and they go on trips and camping excursions, and they get themselves in varying levels of peril sometimes. But this one, they're supposed to go on a train through the mountains, and there's a girl and her grandfather who run the like a historic train line, and there's a dam, I think, that breaks, and so the valley is going to be completely flooded if they can't get out of there. Though the, you know, the whole class is at risk, and the teacher and everybody. And so I think Astro Boy perhaps tries to help, but he's doing other things, and ultimately the train has to be powered somehow to make it go as fast as possible. It has, you know, different problems, different issues, but they realize that ultimately the grandfather is a robot, and he puts his power cell, or essentially merges with the engine, to be able to save his granddaughter and the class. And I don't, there's something about that one too. It's very moving. It's a very moving episode. There are a few that are actually quite moving. Even the original one was moving, where Toby gets hit by a car, and he is basically the original visual lookalike of Astro Boy, and the scientist that then creates Astro Boy the robot is the father, and is building Astro Boy in his son's image. It's quite a moving and quite dark. I mean, that's what anime tends to do, I suppose. It has dark subject matter sometimes and laces it with kind of cutesy themes or visuals, and yeah, it can sort of go from extreme to extreme very, very quickly. But yeah, Astro Boy is one of those ones that will always have that place in my, you know, in my memories. And it was definitely one that, you know, that we remember very fondly. Now, we enjoyed shows like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Cops, Mask, like things like Robotech. We used to enjoy one that was called Star Blazers, which was a little older. It was a little an older animated one. I have since watched the intro sort of theme once or twice, and it's so dated, the animation style. It's done in a really beautiful, simple way, but I remember loving that as a kid, because it's about a ship that's converted into a spacecraft and then flies through the, you know, the solar system or the galaxy, helping people wherever it goes. I mean, that was fantastic. We loved that one. It bears some similarities to, I guess, the Voltron idea and others that are a bit similar to that. But yeah, we really liked that one. And Hercules, which I forget the year, 30 something. But that was always good as well. Hercules had a great theme song, and that was quite a dark one as well, because he had to journey through the kingdom of Hades, and there were all these people, I think, that were in stasis, kind of like hanging there, suspended animation, waiting to be freed. And that had its dark edge as well. Another one that I think was originally a Japanese anime, but because of the heavy editing that the Americans did to it when they bought the show for syndication, they re-edited it and also cut in new parts, because originally it was a Earth-based show. And I can't think of its original name, of course, because I'm on the move and I can never think straight. But it became Battle of the Planets. And Battle of the Planets was turned into Battle of the Planets, a sci-fi space traveling saga, because of the success of Star Wars. So they did a re-edit where there is Seven Zark Seven, who is is based in an underwater sort of sea base, and is a very, very R2-D2-like robot, who talks through some of the story points, or has a sort of a side plot often, because of course it was completely added it doesn't always have a lot to do with the story that's currently going on. It's just a nice little extra that fluffs it out and also makes it a little more kid-friendly. Look, and as children, we loved it. We thought it was a fantastic show. We've got the characters that have these suits, like eagles, hawks, sparrows, and they've got all different vehicles. And they go out there, and even no matter which planet it was purported to be on, it always looked like Earth. Because, of course, when you research about it, it was Earth. But it didn't matter. It doesn't matter as kids. You just watch it, soak it all up, love it. So Battle of the Planets, of course, had a wonderful theme as well. That was another one that I really, really loved when it started, because they had like a trumpet fanfare with a kind of dawning, the dawning sun over a planet as it sort of orbits. And that was just a really exciting intro as well, and you used to love it when that came on. But that was more of a late 70s cartoon, and there's a slight difference in styles, you know, when you look at these. I think Star Blazers was probably similar, like a late 70s edition. So the music, the stylings, the animation style and quality, it's all a little bit different to some of the stuff that came in the 80s. Now, Astro Boy was given a reboot in the early 2000s, and it wasn't too bad, and it even had an animated movie, I think, that maybe came out late noughties, as they call them, I think. I've never seen it. I'm not entirely sure I will. I'd be too fussed about it. Sort of, I like to cling on to the memories of the show that I sort of grew up with and really like. So, you know, maybe one day. But yeah, I tend to be a bit traditional in that way and stick to what I know. So another one. Now, I talked about Battle of the Planets, He-Man, Astro Boy. Another one that really stood out, and I think it was one that not everyone is... It's probably not as well known as some of the ones I've already mentioned. But The Mysterious Cities of Gold, and I was very kindly reminded by my older brother, thanks, mate, about this one. Because it was... I'm not sure if it was a Japanese production or not. I have never really looked into the history of that either, other than it was a little bit different in that at the end it used to have a little documentary kind of shot, real footage clip, where it talked about an element of South American culture. And that was a cool little insight when the cartoon itself was actually set in the Age of Discovery and was Magellan's sort of expedition and set around that time, where really the Americas were only just discovered. And I recall they were trying to... There were the Straits of Magellan was part of it, and there was a sort of a lead explorer, and they set sail from Spain and were going to try and find El Dorado, the fabled cities of gold. And there was a child, I think a boy, who was a stowaway, who then, I guess, gets found and becomes a bit more incorporated into the voyage itself and all the trials and tribulations that brings. But also, in their travels, they meet other characters as well, some native kids as well. But there's also, he has a talisman which he wears around his neck that sort of has mysterious origins. And through the telling, you know, through the subsequent episodes, and they discover that the girl character that they meet also has one of these symbols, and they join. And that becomes a key for these very advanced vehicles that are housed throughout the Andes and on this journey to El Dorado. And yeah, all these vehicles are made of gold. So such is the richness and the advanced nature of the ancient population that used to be there, is that they've got this amazing city with these vehicles far advanced, of course, than our own. So I remember one particularly was like this huge golden eagle, and they could fly in that. And it had this great theme song as well. It's very different for a cartoon. Really bouncy, kind of had elements of South American feel in it, and a great melody. I don't know, it just had this fantastic thing. I really should One day when I'm doing these episodes, I should go back and edit. And when I'm talking about these things that I'm referring to, I should play a little clip of it, because I think that would help people go, oh, that show. Yeah, I remember that show too. Because sometimes it's that little sort of prompting with audio that makes you, I don't know, all the memories come flooding back, because some people, you know, you put it away in the back of your mind or just clean forgotten about it because it's been so long. But something like that can really bring it all rushing back. And that's always a beautiful kind of experience. I love that. When you're just like, oh, yeah, love that one. So Mysterious Cities of Gold was definitely one of those, because I think through conversations with my brothers and friends that were, you know, enjoyed the same, I guess, era of cartoons as well, you just remember it fondly. You all of a sudden you're like, that's right, Dan. You talk about it all excitedly, and you jumble up the facts sometimes, as I probably have done so today. But I think it's about how you remember the show that makes it kind of live on and be sustained for so much longer after the fact. So thinking more about some of the other cartoons, G.I. Joe was something that we probably tended to get more in comic book form. Well, certainly my brother used to get a lot of the comics, and we used to enjoy those. But they did have a cartoon as well. I think that the thing that irritated me, even as a child, was the amount of lasers. And of course, no one ever seemed to get hurt by them. But I guess, you know, of course, looking at it from an adult's perspective, you can't have a very, very violent show on television with guns and bullets and everything. So they worked out a way to do it where it wasn't going to be over-the-top violence, and there was vehicles getting blown up and people would be thrown from the wreckage, and even if they were captive, they were normally rescued or released or something crazy like that. It doesn't make a lot of sense in perspective, based on the fact that they're all trying to take over the world, Cobra trying to take over the world, but it did work. It made sure that they could do it and then have it screened and televised at the right time of day to meet all the right guidelines, just like just like He-Man had to do for its screening as well, to soften all of the violence, so it became something where it just was non-existent. They didn't use the sword to actually stab anybody. It was the sword was a symbol of power, but it was used to, you know, protect people or to fire a bolt of something or break a rock that was blocking the tunnel. It was always something more like that, a little cleaner. But that's understandable as well. There was a very short-lived Rambo cartoon, which was actually not that great. We used to enjoy all those things. I mean, we liked Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles too. We watched a fair bit of that back in the day. And I mean, that had many, many seasons, I think. And yeah, it's one of those things where I think that era, that sort of mid-80s to late 80s, early 90s, was where the cartoons that we remember the most and have the most fondness for kind of came from. And that was probably more due to our age at the time as well. And I'd be curious to see what people from the different generations remember from their childhood. So whether it was a cartoon like the ones I'm talking about, but like from the era that we're discussing, or the one that where they were, you know, 6 years old to about 12. And I might put that up somewhere and try and get some feedback, because I'd be very curious to know. I mean, obviously Pokemon and Dragon Ball Z, and I don't know if Beyblades had any kind of cartoon. But yeah, to me, see, none of these make sense to me. Even though they make perfect sense to the people who are big fans and love the shows and watch them all the time. So I'd be curious to get that perspective from people who have fond memories of other shows. Or if you share any of the same ones that I do, you know, feel free to let me know that as well. And that discussion can keep going, because I like being educated. And look, there's probably a ton of shows that I've also neglected to mention as well that I've enjoyed, but I needed to talk about those. It's really at the forefront of my mind when I think about kids' television from back then and what I enjoyed. So that kind of brings us to the end of my little flashback on anime and kids' series and all that sort of thing. So I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm not sure. There could be like a little extra segment. I'm not sure at the moment. It's kind of like doing it where I do have some time. So I think I'll put this up at the start of next week, and I hope you join me to listen to it, and then, you know, I'll try and stay a bit more regular than I have been of late. As I was talking about in the last episode, I've been, you know, caught up in different things, and doesn't mean that I don't enjoy this, and I don't want to keep it going. So, yeah, by all means, stick with me, and we're going to have fun and talk about all sorts of random stuff. But look, give me more to talk about. Give me some fuel for discussion. And it doesn't have to be hobbies and interests necessarily. I did a little bit of social, political commentary several episodes ago, and, you know, I enjoyed doing it. I don't like getting too critical or judgy when it comes to my opinion on things like that. But if that's what people would like to hear, I'm more than happy to have a think about something, sort of have some kind of input or insight into it, or even if it's not insight, it's just an ignorant person's point of view. It can be interesting for others. So if there's anything like that you want to bring up with me, feel free to get in touch. It's Swamp Bastard Guitars on Instagram, and the Master of None podcast at gmail.com. So until the next time, have a great week, look after yourselves, and have fun. See you later. Anyways, I'm back again. I thought I'd do an extra little segment here because I feel like it's going to be another few days before I get this episode up and away. But I thought I'd talk about alternative building methods. It was something that Luke and I were chatting about on Fly on the Wall podcast a couple of different times and kind of scooted over the subject. And I realised it's actually something quite dear to my heart and something I really enjoy kind of just researching and looking into. Certainly by no means a master of it, or else I wouldn't be doing this podcast. But something I certainly enjoy and definitely like learning a lot more about, you know, through the years as trends change and people come up with different ideas about how to use renewables and be more self-sufficient in terms of the house and the most energy efficient it can be, and I guess recycled materials, etc., etc. It's just a fascinating field of work. And, I drive around all over the city, all over Melbourne, and you look at the new construction methods that are employed, and I don't know, it just doesn't do much for me. I realise that they can build faster, they can build probably more affordably on the whole, and they can build with materials that are easier to work with, and also insulation-wise, maybe offer the same kind of benefits that older and heavier and more expensive materials might have used to have offered in the past. But the overwhelming majority that are built within a certain price bracket seem to be the ones that you can see cracks in after 5-6 years, or there's defects right from day one, you know, with different elements of the build. And these issues with apartments in the city and up in Sydney and then overseas, where they've tried to do something. And look, the building itself might be old, but there are some new builds where there've been some horrendous issues. And whether that's in the foundation, like when they're setting the foundations and building that, and they're just trying to speed the process along, and so haven't done that as thoroughly as they could, it doesn't fill you with confidence about where the building industry is going these days. I think if you come down to a smaller level, things like, and I mean literally as well as figuratively, if you look at the tiny house movement, that's actually a really interesting one, and I think one that has a lot of promise. When the GFC hit in 2008, particularly in America too, and that's where a lot of the home loans were, you know, put into foreclosure, or, you know, the bank ended up mortgaging the house to pay off the loan because people couldn't afford to pay it, or it just, yeah, the bottom fell out of the whole market. So it really stuffed people up and really hurt a lot of people. And I guess they were looking at an alternative where they could have a home and be comfortable, call it theirs, but not have shelled out hundreds of thousands of dollars, more like tens of thousands of dollars. And even something that isn't put on a parcel of their land, it's sharing a piece of land with other like-minded people. And I can see where the appeal lies. I mean, particularly for probably semi-retired, retired couples, retired singles, you know, younger couples that might just have a pet, even couples that might have a young child, and also single people. You know, for a small family dynamic, a tiny house is perfect. And in this day and age where a lot of people are kind of shirking the, you know, I need this, I need this, I need this, they sort of, yes, they're particular about what they like, but they do try to keep things at a minimum, or that's what it seems to be like from what I can see online and from some of the people that have chosen to live in this particular lifestyle. They choose it because they want to simplify things and they want to have a comfortable space that it's their own, but it doesn't need to be overwhelmed with stuff. It's kind of like the perfect IKEA display room, but it's a functional, living, breathing house. And I've seen some amazing ones. And I mean, this goes, they're not all called tiny houses. Tiny houses, in my kind of eyes, or my understanding, is more the ones that are built on a tandem trailer, like a standard tandem trailer. It's a certain length, certain width, and you can build the home on there, and it's possible to move it then to that block of land that you're looking at having. But that's not to say that other small homes and tiny homes are built more permanently. And there was a couple that I've seen online where it's more people just trying their hand at building, say, a log cabin or small mud brick dwelling, just building it themselves. And so you stay the size, you keep it low, so you can actually feel like you've achieved something and something that's livable within a reasonable space of time. Because, of course, when you do these things and you want to do it alone and by yourself, and a lot of these people are first-time builders, you kind of iron out the issues as you go, and you don't take off, you don't bite off more than you can chew in the one sort of sitting. Sitting's the wrong word, but you know what I mean. It's something where they can build a whole sort of single-room living space in a matter of weeks if they really want to, if they've got that focus and that time to be able to put into it. And it's something where, particularly log cabins, I have a real recent appreciation for log cabins. I've always liked them, but then started to think about, well, you know, I wonder if I could, you know, buy a cheap block of land out in country Victoria somewhere, because that is where cheap land is still available, out there in the middle of nowhere. Because now within the city kind of outskirts, even, you know, 2 hours from the city, it's still pricey enough to kind of scare you off from that idea. But occasionally you can get an undeveloped, unconnected piece of land that's still affordable because it doesn't have any of those connections, sewerage, electricity, anything, water. And so therefore, if you were to choose to build a dwelling, you've got all the permits you'd have to look into, and then you'd have to get, you know, depending what your building material is and everything, there's still a lot of checks and assessments that you'd have to have done to be permitted to build a permanent dwelling. So there's certain boundaries that can be skirted when the house is of a certain size, a certain value, I guess when it's not too grandiose. So if the footings are, you know, essentially they're a minimum of this, you know, and you've followed building regulations as far as, you know, you haven't done anything outside of the rules. You've done everything to the rules, but you just haven't sought approval. I think there's only so much they could do, because you can just call it a weekender and it's perfectly acceptable. It's like putting a caravan and an annex on a bit of land. And as long as it's not for permanent dwelling, I think that, I mean, and people live there, I'm sure they do, all the time. So I guess there's always loopholes in these systems where people have found a great little sidestepping way to not have to go through all the expensive channels. And I like that idea. If I was to consider moving out somewhere permanently, I think I probably would have to go down the straight and narrow. But as far as like just doing something as a little bit of a project, or with the intention of having it as a weekender, or, you know, a place to hang out with your kids or your missus or your mates on a weekend away, I think it'd be fine. You're literally taking your sleeping bags up there for 2-3 nights, having a fire, doing a bit of cooking. And most of your cooking is probably something where, if you're going to choose to go out that way, you're going to want to do it over the fire, or you want to just have a barbecue in a shelter outside. So I don't think it's something where you have to overthink it and have a fully functioning kitchen. I think, you know, some kind of running water is brilliant, of course, for showers and washing and all that sort of stuff. You need some form of composting toilet because the base necessities are always lovely as well. And then you need some kind of power. So whether or not for the start you've just got a generator or you just stick to using, you know, battery-powered things and you just don't overstretch your resources, I don't think it would be an issue at all. And then at some point you get a simple solar panel set up with a small battery and inverter and off you go. It'd probably be enough to power your lights through the evening, maybe run a couple of low voltage sort of appliances, and then you'd use a fire, or you get these great, I forget what they're called because I always do when I'm doing the podcasts, but you can get a stove that is basically, it'll do all of your functioning. You know, it'll heat the room. You can do your cooking on it because it'll have a fitting for a kettle. It'll have a fitting for a saucepan. It'll have some kind of oven sort of off to the side, an oven chamber. But it'll also have the ability to heat water and, you know, pipe that out to something. So whether you just have that heating up for, say, a shower and your sink. And that's, I mean, that's really all you want anyway. You just want that access to some nice fresh hot water. And as long as you know, well, I've had the fire on this evening, so I'm not going to probably have the hot water for too long through the night, so get everything done. Like, I like that idea. I like the fact you've got to plan it out, but you've still got that comfort. That's what appeals to me about the whole lifestyle. And I suppose as a weekend or as a holiday, perfect. Couldn't think of anything nicer, to be honest. So it's something that, and this is what we talked about on the Fly on the Wall, but look, if you're not one of the listeners to the Fly on the Wall podcast, I don't mind repeating myself, and it gives me a bit more of a reference point when I'm speaking to sort of dart back to and think, oh, that's right, I was talking about that. When I was a young man, 18, 19, I don't even remember the thing that sparked my interest in mud brick houses and alternative building methods, but I did get interested in it, and I just started reading some different magazines that were available at the time. Not even sure if they're still available or not now. There was Grassroots, Earth Garden, and Owner Builder. And Owner Builder was the one that really sort of took my fancy because it talked about all the things I was interested in. And it would often have a couple of feature houses with some photography throughout the house and lots of different methods involved in sort of building that house. And a lot of these projects are the product of, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of work off and on, because a lot of the people have been working the whole time, and, you know, they might be teachers or doctors or some other kind of profession, and they've just done it in their spare time, and they've lived, some of them have lived in a caravan on the same property for 10 years. So there's a lot of commitment involved. And there's often a lot of that, I guess, that feeling of non-permanence for a while. But once they've achieved that goal, that's something they've built, and, you know, that's theirs forever. And it doesn't matter, I guess, even if they sell it. That's still something they've created, and I guess that's what I really love about it too. It's a house is not just anything. It's something really, really tangible. You know, it's sitting there. People live in it. People make their lives in it. People might have children in it. It's sort of, it's a thing of great beauty. It sounds sarcastic. I don't really mean it that way. I just thought I'd sound a bit like a bit of a tosser. But I really appreciate what it means to people and the different projects they've done. And some of the best ones have been the type that are literally pulled out of, recycled building goods stores, or, you know, a wrecking house, you know, where they're clearing the block. And that's happening a lot these days, particularly through Melbourne, where old original dwellings are pulled down to make way for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 townhouses. And it's something that you just go, oh, I mean, that's terrible. But, you know, if you're watching when these places get pulled down, sometimes they've got people that go in and they sort of salvage what they need. Sometimes they're literally just ripped out and everything's thrown out. And I guess if you've got your hand, if you've got your, I guess, your eyes on the prize and your finger on the pulse of these projects, you can probably pop in and say, like, well, what could I pay for, you know, that set of windows, that door there, some of the old hardwood framing, you know, what can I give you? And then a lot of them will be old brick buildings, and there's so much good scrap in there that people could almost build a simple house out of some of the scrap. And that fascinates me too. I really like that. I prefer that. I love mud brick houses because that's literally, you know, dug up out of the ground, normally on the block you're on. You can buy mud bricks pre-done from different companies that offer it. I doubt that there's a whole heap of them around, but there are areas popular with that building method, probably because of the soil suitability. And you can buy, I guess, a batch, and that would make it a little easier. Particularly, I mean, even if you tried and you'd build several hundred, you'd made several hundred of your own, and you just thought, wow, by the time I get, let's say I need, I don't know, 3,000 bricks, I'm going to be an old man. So they might have done 600, 700, 800, and they might purchase the rest. But I guess, look, I can understand the sentiment. At least there's that option to still complete it the way that you want to complete it. People buy the old telecom, telegraph poles, telephone poles, the power poles, the big straight timber poles that have got a nice diameter to them, slight taper, and they're very long. And they're often used as the center posts and the main posts for these infill kind of idea houses, because you can get the two types of mud bricks when talking about mud bricks. You can get weight-bearing mud bricks, and you can get the non-weight-bearing mud bricks. And I kind of, probably because I've got no idea about building methods overall, I like pole and beam, post and beam construction, because it can be done in sections. It can be built to be sheltered, dry. You can camp inside, upstairs in the property, make a sort of an upper mezzanine floor, sort of canvas it in or tarp it in, and you can then build the mud brick walls when you're ready within the pre-done sections. And I think that just appeals to me as a way of being able to do sections of it and feel like little achievements, rather than with a full weight bearing wall, you've got to build the whole thing, I guess, as best you can before you can start to use it, you know, putting up a roof on top and framing it up like that. I didn't really ever look too much into that method because I guess it didn't excite me, it didn't excite my senses. So I always looked into the other one, and they basically run a course of mud bricks and then a course of the mud mortar. And then I think every two or three courses they run a length of barbed wire between the posts, and that sort of sets itself into the mortar. And then that, you of course have to remember where you put your window plinths to strengthen that section. So it's like a length of wood over the section where you're going to insert your window and secure it in. And so all these things are pre-done. I suppose that's the, you know, if some people have built, I'm sure, without a plan, probably just with a drawing. But I like the idea of having a plan of some depth, because you could, I guess, solve a lot of your problems before they arise. Having water pipes exposed on the inside of a house or the external side of the house doesn't really bother me. I think it kind of adds to the industrial, earthy kind of charm. I like the idea of having fairly rough cut kind of posts and beams. And I stayed at a house with my family for a sort of a birthday gift 1 year, and it was it was an amazing house. It was built that way, the post and beam with mud brick infill walls, and there was this beautiful wall inside where, see, for most part they render the external and internal mud brick wall to protect it more from the weather and rodents and insects and ants and all that sort of stuff. So it has like a spray render all over it that you can hand mix as well and apply like that. But this internal wall was bare, and I think was just coated with some kind of clear, whether it was naturally derived or not, I don't know. But it looked amazing. It showed all the little details. You could see bits of the straw in there, little stone pieces, and clumps of the clay, different coloured parts of the dirt that they mixed through. Honestly, it just showed so much detail in how each of those bricks was moulded and dried and then assembled into this wall. I love the fact that they did a feature wall that was just raw mud brick. And I think if that was something I was going to try to do, a mud brick house, I would want to do the same. I think I would have to have a wall in the house that I could just look at and be like, yep, they're my bricks. And, you know, hopefully one day that's something we can make happen. It's always been something I've always had, like, domain and real estate, like, apps, or I used to always pick up the real estate books and just flick through it and try and find, you know, oh, let's see what the cheapest house in this area is. Let's see what the biggest block of land for the cheapest price is. Let's have a look and see, you know, what kind of trees we can get on a bush block. Just, and always for that end, building something using what was there. And I still like that idea. That's certainly something that hasn't lost its intrigue for me, its excitement. I'd love that. Even if it was out west, you get a lot of volcanic sites where there's a lot of the scoria rock. And it would be great to build like the foundations of a house with using some of that stone. It would be an amazing thing. I'm not sure what I would do with the foundations of a mud brick house. I feel like it could be either. It could be either using stumps underneath and then have bearers and joists and then floorboards so that there's actually a cavity under the floor. But also like the idea of almost having a solid slab as well. But I'm not sure what I would get that laid with. Like, I guess in my head, I'd be wanting to start as soon as possible and, you know, oh, could you get that poured because then it makes it nice and fast. But there's something in me that would want to do it so the whole thing had been kind of handmade. So I guess in my mind, I'm thinking, well, some bits could be brick, like paved through some of the passageways and so the bathrooms, but with ample drainage and like a moisture... I forget everything when I'm speaking. A damp course, that's what they call it. Like a plastic damp course run through because otherwise you get rising damp from the soil. So it's good to plan ahead and try and work out ways around those things. But yeah, I like the idea of doing a bit of a mixture of say, brick paving, like a mud slab floor in some sections. And then if needed in others, you could have the floating... The floorboards that, you know, are so common, you know. And, yeah, I guess, yeah, there's lots of other little details. It would be great to use a stack of mismatched windows and, like, an old wagon wheel as a kind of feature up high in the arch. Always like the look of those when people do a bit of LED lighting or get them cast with some glass panels. There, and then there's lots of other weird stuff too. People use glass bottles, all sorts of different... coloured glass bottles to create windows, and that we've always had those they're called bottle brick, but those glass bricks that you can buy, and, you know, used to be a big thing back in the day. I guess people use dividing partitions in their bathrooms and yeah, just a feature in their kitchen or what have you, in their bathroom. That's probably the ideal one because then you don't get clear vision but you still get all that light. You could do it as a window up higher in the bathroom. All that stuff is really appealing, and I like the people that have said, oh, we didn't realise we had any windows, we didn't have anything at the time that was suited for there. So we looked around, saw what we could find, and we managed to get a whole batch of 1,000 recycled beer bottles. And we decided we'd try this, just make a window using that, using a slight mud mixture in between them to set them all, and voila, there you go, there's a window. That stuff excites me. I love it. I love it when people can just go with it, go with the flow and create different ideas as they go, as they create. We talked, Luke and I talked a little bit about hay bale. I'm not a huge fan of hay bale, mainly because everything's got to be so much bigger just to accommodate it. But I know they make smaller hay bale, I guess essentially they're bricks, for the building thing rather than like a big... chunky looking hay bale, but it's just not a building method that's ever really excited me. I like the fact that people do it and try it, but it's not one that really grabs my interest. The mud brick, the post and beam, that's definitely up the top for me, but I certainly have looked into some of the other ones as well. The rammed earth is interesting. It's not something that I would want to build anything out of in its entirety. I think I would try it just to see how it works, how it looks, and maybe just in a little feature somewhere. Just be like, well, we tried rammed earth there. It's just a little area. Same with tyres. It's essentially rammed earth into the tyres, and vertical posts are sort of there to then weave your tyres over. You set them like bricks. So you would do two, then one that sort of covers both halves of the other, and sort of weave them like that, like laying brick courses with posts to hold all of those the tyres in place. And then I think, yeah, earth is poured each course into each tyre, and it's kind of packed down, and then when it goes off, it's obviously a very, very heavy and thick and well-insulated wall. Just another way of doing the rammed earth without the moulds. It's like pre-done moulds. That kind of interests me as well, I guess, as just something to try somewhere else. I don't like the aesthetic of weaving the tyres and then trying it. It would be something that I think I might do on a, you know, an outhouse of some sort, or maybe a studio room, or an outdoor laundry, a guest house. I don't know, just to try it outside of the importance of the main dwelling. But it's still something that I would be willing to try. There was something I read about in one of them about a guy who'd made a dwelling completely out of train sleepers. He'd split some and he'd been able to mill some down slightly, but for most part, it was like, essentially like Jenga, where you stack the blocks to make the shape, and you know, you can sort of intersect the corners, a bit like a log cabin as well. I suppose that's probably the best explanation. Logs are hollowed out slightly on every corner, so when they sit down, they lock into the other log facing down the other length of wall, and so on and so forth until you build it up. It's like stack it up, like if you remember ever doing a paddle pop stick construction or pencil holder in kinder or primary school. It's just one of those common things you make. So you just interweave those paddle pops to build your structure. It's basically the same principle with log cabins and with the sleeper house that I'm talking about now. And I like the concept. I think it's a great concept. And they actually do pre-done homes now, and particularly small studios and little sheds and cubbies with this system. And it's very, very well finished and milled wood. Something about that doesn't appeal to me. I like that it's so easy. It's like putting a Lego set together. But and it'd be great for a little, you know, backyard project. But I'm not sure I like the appeal of building a whole house that way. I would definitely like the sleeper idea appeals, but it was really a very rough weekend cabin. That one I don't think it had a floor. I think it was literally a smoothed out mud floor, and just sort of built up, or had some stone layers under it. And yeah, it wouldn't have been ideal to stay in for an extended time, because it probably would be a little damp. It's just like a mud hut. You wouldn't want to live there for too long before kind of considering an alternative. But still a great idea, and something that would be fun to just give a go to. There's lots of videos on YouTube of like primitive survival, where they use like wattle and daub construction and woven sticks, and then they pack it full of the mud, and then they start building clay and clay pottery, I guess, like a bowl and different implements using stone or sticks, and basically sort of assembling a very primitive life. And they've literally started with nothing. So the one that I did watch is, he chooses a suitable rock and then fashions a hatchet out of the rock. And then that is used for, I think, almost everything. Almost everything. Cutting down the trees, the suitable trees. It is a really fascinating thing to watch, because you go, wow, this guy's actually achieved all of this using just his hands at the start, and then gone from there to create everything else. It is very, very impressive to watch. I forget exactly what it's called, but Primitive is definitely in the title, and I would highly recommend having a look if this kind of thing appeals to you at all, because that's kind of like, that's the base level. That's where you start. Absolute rock bottom with nothing is, you know, alternative building methods. And then from there, you know, you might look into the mud brick and the other methods, the log cabin. The log cabin ones I've watched, and the best ones are always seem to be overseas in Canada and Alaska and the northern United States, where there's a lot more dead straight kind of pines and different trees that grow nice and straight like that. And people can buy a parcel of land for, well, not pittance, but a good price, and put their house together over a time frame. There was a particular one I watched where I don't think there was any video. It was a series of photographs over time, and they kept going up over long weekends and holidays for over quite a while, from Montana, I think. And they would drive to Alaska to their block, and they would have a handgun there to protect themselves from bears and their dog, and they would do as much as they could while they were there. And this is everything: cutting down each of the trees, stripping them of the bark, hauling them back to the site, the cabin site, then notching them out so they could then build them up until they had the full building. And I mean, that took a long time to get that full height cabin built. And then you've got to put in the trusses and all that sort of stuff to be able to mount your roof. But they did an amazing job, and it ended up being just a decent size cabin, kind of like open living, but had a mezzanine floor where the sleeping quarters were. And I think it had a spiral staircase, but it had a little bit of space for everything, and it had a little deck out the front. And they ended up, you know, putting on a door and some windows and, you know, making it really nice. But the finished product was just amazing. They did an amazing job. It would have been a beautiful place to spend a few days every so often whenever you could get the chance. I'd love to find that particular site or that couple again, just to see where they're at and if they kept that site, or if they ended up living there, you know, as their family situation changed, because they were a couple, but they didn't have kids at that time. They just had a dog, so I guess they could do that. They make those choices. But as soon as you start having family, I guess you've got to make a hard decision about, you know, do we just want to keep it as a weekender, or do we want to make this more permanent? So it was definitely an interesting story. I wish I could remember the name of the site or the couple or whatever, but I've got no idea. But I do remember that it was basically a log cabin, and they were from Montana, and they went to Alaska to a block of land that they bought. So I would highly recommend, if you're interested in watching a good log cabin building, that you know, just search them up, because there's so much online. There's so much. People do time-lapse videos of the building of whatever they're doing, whatever their little project is. There's tons of tiny house documentaries and YouTube series, and they'll go in and check out different houses all the time. And there's something to appeal to everybody. You know, you can get really, really modern ones that look like a beach house in, you know, Brighton down here. Really modern and sort of futuristic looking. And then you get these others that are nice, old-fashioned little homesteady kind of appearing ones. And you get some that look really different, really quirky, and not kind of a little bit off what you'd expect. But that's the thing. It can reflect the uniqueness of the builder, and also the materials that might have been available, or their budget, etc., etc. So definitely have a look if you get a chance. There's probably a lot more to talk about, but I've just realized my battery warning just came up. And I've also been talking half an hour, and I'm thinking of intersecting this particular segment with the He-Man and everything, chatting about cartoons and everything. So just so it's a varied episode. So again, thank you very, very much for joining me. When I listen to this back, hopefully it all makes sense when I string it together. I am hoping to kind of put some incidental music at the start and end again, but something that's not going to be an issue with copyright. That's why I actually dropped off using the other track. Because I don't want it to be a problem. It's not that it was a problem, I just don't want it to be a problem. So I'm hoping to give it a little more polish that way. But look, it is a down-to-earth podcast. Hopefully it's something that a few of you, you know, enjoy and don't mind coming back to revisit and having listened to. If you've got anything that you want to suggest, something you want to hear about, something you want to share with me, something you just want to hear someone actually talk about, please let me know. I don't mind talking about serious topics. This is a hobbies and interests podcast. But I did get a question a little while ago from my son's mate about, you know, a kind of my view of politics today, and I had a bit of a ramble about all that, and I think that was okay. It wasn't really too heavy, so look, I don't mind what you want to hear. It's nice to just be able to chat about things you're interested in and things that you want to, I guess, hear other opinions on and get different thoughts on. And sometimes I see what I do, this just doing the podcast, it's just like thinking out loud. And sometimes things can seem different once you've done that. And it's a bit weird to sit there in a car talking to yourself out loud. So it makes a lot more sense to just chat and think that it's going out to at least a small audience. And, you know, it might be of interest to people. So, you know, thanks very much for listening. It's always appreciated. Always get in touch. It's the masterofnonepodcast@gmail.com. And you can check out my Instagram, which is Swamp Bastard Guitars, on there. There's also Fly on the Wall Podcast on Instagram as well. So I'm sort of always linked into that as well. So you can get in touch through that as well. And that's about it from me. So enjoy the episode once I've got it up there. And you'll hear from me soon. Take care, and I'll catch you later. Bye.